State versus Madryn, you may approach.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Petter Bartling. I am the attorney for James Madryn. Mr. Madryn proceeded to jury trial in the District Court for Douglas County in November of 2018 on an amended information charging him with one count first-degree sexual assault. We are here today to ask this court to vacate the judgment that the District Court for Douglas County entered in this matter, including the sentence, send the matter back for a new trial based on the challenge to the integrity of the judicial system that Mr. Madryn's conviction poses. Specifically, in our brief, we assigned 7 errors. I'm going to address orally 2 of the 7 and submit numbers 3 through 7 on the written argument. The principal contention of Mr. Madryn that the appearance of fairness in the system and the integrity of the system is called into question by his conviction is that at the time the judge discharged the jury, instructed them to go render a verdict, the judge sent 13 persons to the jury room. Those 13 persons included the 12 jurors by statute and a non-juror, that is the alternate, that the court failed to discharge. Unlike this court's prior precedent, this is clear from the record. The trial judge engaged in a colloquy not only with counsel for the state and defense counsel, but also with the jurors that the judge brought back into the room to discuss the presence of a non-juror participating in deliberations. The BOE, or the record in this case, reflects that that conversation took place after deliberations began, and there was at least 1 hour of deliberations at the time that conversation took place. The court attempted to remedy that situation by issuing what is essentially a cautionary instruction or eliminating instruction to the jury, number one, and number two, saying to the jurors, you must go back to the jury room and start from scratch, or as the court said, quote, start again from scratch, meaning that your deliberations that you've had to this point are out the window, and now you're going to deliberate anew.
Then after the verdict, there was additional questioning of the jury by the trial judge, was there not?
Correct. Yes,
and,
judge.
And as a result of that, the jurors indicated that there had been no influence by the discharged juror during the initial part of the deliberations.
The jurors that remained, the actual jurors, indicated that they had reached a verdict in their opinion that was based on their deliberations absent the 13th person, the non-juror. That's correct. The challenge, again, here is this is a structural error. This is not a harmless error analysis. This isn't something that's subject to a cautionary instruction. It's not something that's subject to limiting instruction. We can find the reasoning and the structure for that in any number of places in Nebraska. Nebraska Constitution Article 1, Section 6 discusses 12 jurors only. Article 1, Section 11 also discusses 12 jurors. The state of Nebraska's judicial branch on its website defines a jury as either 6 or 12 people. Nebraska Jury Instruction Number 1, Subsection 10 talks about the influence of non-jurors and the outside parties.
Let me interrupt you for 1 second.
Yes, sir.
Is it your position by saying it's a structural error? Is it your position that the minute that judge inadvertently sent 13 jurors back there, that was there, it's done?
Correct.
You don't think that there's a prejudicial analysis here as it relates to this?
No. It's structural. Under Chapter 29, the legislators made very clear that there are regular jurors and alternate jurors. Case law makes it very clear that an alternate juror is a non-juror. It is a non-adjudicator of fact. I cited several cases, both from this jurisdiction and other jurisdictions, in the written argument that discuss that person, that non-juror, is essentially a stranger to the process. It is, in effect, no different than having a member of the media back there, a member of the prosecution's team back there, the defense team. It is someone who is not allowed to be in a space. And I understand what the judge did here. The judge realized that this was an error of, in his opinion, inadvertence. Defense counsel moved for a mistrial and said this is systemic and cannot be overcome by cautioning, telling them to restart, essentially unringing the bell. We don't know what impact from the face of this record that original period of deliberation had on a subsequent verdict. And that's why it is structural, because there's a presumption in the law that you cannot send anyone other than the 12 back.
Period. But isn't it a rebuttable presumption? And I'm thinking of the case of State versus Manui from our Supreme Court.
Well, and I cited that as well. I think that presumption is not rebuttable. I think it is structural.
But that's what the court said, right?
The court did indicate that there was some opportunity to rebut that presumption.
And we're bound by that precedent, aren't we?
Yes, court? Judge. Yeah. Correct. My position, Mr. Madron's position, is that this record does not rebut that presumption. This record simply says, yes, we did start again, and yes, we did come, and I speak as the jurors, yes, we did come to another verdict, and we did that on our own. But what it doesn't say is there was no influence of the previous process here. It simply says, Judge, you told us to go back to the chambers, which we did. You excused the non-juror and told us to start from scratch, which we did. And at that point in time, we then rendered the verdict, which is what the court entered. That being said, what we don't know and what defense trial counsel's position was is that there is no way to distinguish those original arguments the original discussions that the jurors had from the subsequent discussions, and we weren't able to tell in any meaningful way whether, although the jurors said they did start from scratch, the excused non-juror's participation in a process to which that person had no right to participate made an impact on the ultimate verdict.
So the question the court asked is, of the jury, did any one of you in reaching your verdict consider any of the conversations or participation of the alternate juror while she was with you in the jury room? Nobody responded.
Well, no response is not a no. And I think
the court on the record asked each and every one of them, and we'd have a verbal response on the record, would that be different then?
It could be. The challenge here is if you go back before in the record, and this is cited in my brief, the trial judge enters into a discussion at roughly page 484 of the Bill of Exceptions, where the trial judge initially brings the entire body back, the 12 jurors plus the non-juror, and says, ladies and gentlemen, I apologize to you. One of you is the alternate, and I simply forgot to remove the alternate. And I'm skipping forward. Clearly, 13 of you didn't recognize that you still had the alternate. And it's very clear then that the judge also says to counsel, and this is in the record, that the judge, the judge says, and I quote, I do not want to inquire to the exact extent you communicated back and forth. And that's my point, is although we have this lack of response as a suggestion that there is no influence, the court explicitly said in the Bill of Exceptions, I don't want to make the inquiry. I don't. In other words, I don't want to know. And the court didn't know and sent the jurors back for essentially what's a legal mulligan or a do-over. I suggest to you in the brief that under 27-6062, that is not appropriate. I suggest to you in the brief that 29-2004-2 makes the discharge of this person mandatory. So unless the court can conclude absolutely that there was no prejudice to Mr. Madron, structurally, this court ought to send the judgment back because it does affect the integrity of the system. I think about the nature of this case when I first learned of it, and I heard 13 people were in the jury room rendering a verdict. The optics of that don't sound correct, and the reason they don't sound correct is because they aren't correct. There isn't any place that anyone, including the state, can point that says it's okay to have a non-juror in the jury room. What we're really here doing, if we pull back all the veil in this conversation, is simply saying this. The state wants to preserve the judgment, preserve the conviction, and therefore they're saying there was no net negative impact. And Mr. Madron is saying the presence of a non-juror in the jury room is so significant and so negative that it prejudiced him per se. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, I'm Siobhan Duffy, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee, the state of Nebraska. Appellant has assigned numerous errors on appeal, and the state believes all errors to be without merit, and we ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. I do not intend to address each and every single assignment of error today, pending specific questions from this court, and I'll turn to what I think is what we want to talk about, the issue with the jury. Appellant argues that the district court erred in overruling his motion for mistrial based on the district court's failure to dismiss the alternate juror at the beginning of deliberations. While it was error for the district court to fail to dismiss the alternate at the start of deliberations, the steps taken by the district court after it was discovered show that appellant was not prejudiced by what occurred. So just, I know you've already been through the facts, but you know, the court dismissed the alternate, instructed the jury that it needed to begin deliberations anew. When asked if those instructions made sense, the jurors all responded affirmatively. After the jury rendered its verdict, the district court again noted for the jurors that it had been instructed to commence deliberations anew without the alternate, and asked if any member of the jury in rendering its verdict had considered the participation or conversations from the alternate, and no juror responded that they had.
There was just no response.
Correct, but I think I do not take that to mean no response is no. I think the no response is a response. He said, did any of you do this? No one said that they had. I think I interpret that to be no one had considered the participation of the alternate or the conversations that may have been had. The state does not believe that this was structural error and that the question ultimately comes down to whether appellant was prejudiced by what occurred. And the state believes that the record shows that appellant was not prejudiced by this error because the record shows that once this mistake was discovered, 12 jurors began deliberations anew without considering the participations or conversations that may have been had with the alternate juror when rendering their verdict. So the state does not believe that it was structural error, nor do we believe that prejudice has been shown. And so we do not believe the district court erred in denying the motion for mistrial in this regard.
And in the motion for a new trial made, then there was no additional evidence regarding any improper jury communication?
That's correct, Your Honor. There were no affidavits. You know, and again, whether jurors were contacted and said, no, we didn't, we don't know. We don't have a record on what research was done or what that may have showed. But the state also believes that the motion for a new trial was properly denied on that ground as well, because again, while it was error to fail to dismiss the alternate initially, this was cured, no prejudice ended up occurring towards appellant. And again, the motion for a new trial, in brief, appellant argues it regarding the issue with a juror, and the state believes that to be without merit and that the district court properly denied it. Appellant also raises a question with respect to whether there was a violation of the sequestration order at trial. The victim and her mother were seen talking in the hallway after the mother testified, but before the victim did. Appellant argued that it could be presumed they were discussing trial testimony and that jurors witnessed this. The district court inquired of the attorneys, and the state counsel for the states informed them that counsel had informed the parties multiple times they couldn't speak about their testimony, and that in fact that interaction occurred as counsel for the state was walking the mother of the victim out, and that counsel told the mother in the presence of the victim and her father, you cannot discuss what happened. The court did inquire of the jury if anyone had witnessed an interaction between the previous witness in the hall. Three jurors said that they had, but all stated it would not affect their decision on any evidence in the courtroom. So the state believes the district court correctly ruled on that issue as well. There are an issue with appellant alleges there was a violation of an oral motion in limine in which the district court ruled that the mother of the victim could not name the specific mental health diagnosis that the victim had, but that she could describe the conditions that led to the victim being tested. She simply could not name the diagnosis. And at trial, the mother did not name the diagnosis. She described why the victim eventually became tested, as well as her observations of the victim and how things affect her, such as taking time to process before she answers questions and her observations of the victim, which were all matters within her personal knowledge. So she had the foundation to testify to these, and she did not name the diagnosis at trial. And so the state believes the district court correctly allowed this testimony into evidence. Appellant has a few other assigned errors. I believe those are all adequately covered in the state's brief. So unless there
I do have a question.
Sure.
Regarding the two witnesses who testified about delayed reporting of sexual assaults.
The ineffective claim?
Yes. Okay. And I guess the first question is, were they adequately determined to be experts, and if that was necessary?
Your Honor, the claim is made in the guise of an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and the claim was that counsel was ineffective in failing to object to incriminating non-expert but expert testimony. There were kind of three sort of, in the claim, appellant listed the testimony that was had, not the specific people. Three different people gave testimony about these issues. One was the victim's mother, who testified about her observations. As discussed, that's within her knowledge. The other two, as you mentioned, were the forensic interviewer and the police detective. Both gave general information that I think, in reading of these types of cases, that a jury hears a lot, or that on appeal you may see a lot, this court sees, about kind of delayed disclosure, or how sometimes these investigations come about, that sort of thing. I struggle with the idea that requires, when I think of expert, I think of, one of the things the statute mentions is, well, what's the methodology used? What's, this stuff doesn't really involve, I guess, a methodology as much. The expert doesn't actually need to be running tests. Obviously, there is some specialized knowledge that they have. And I think ultimately, putting aside the issue of whether deficient performance was shown, whether these people needed to be qualified as experts, the state at trial, I believe the CV for the, I believe it was the forensic interviewer, was entered into evidence. Both the interviewer and the police detective discussed their training, their education, their experience with these sorts of matters. And I think, and actually, trial counsel did object to some of the police detective's testimony at first, and the state laid additional foundation, made additional inquiry as to the education, skill, and experience this detective had, and then that testimony was allowed to come in. So I think as it relates to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, appellant has not and cannot establish that these two individuals were not qualified to provide the testimony that they did. So setting aside the issue of whether deficient performance was shown, prejudice cannot be shown. So I do think that this claim could be addressed on direct appeal.
It was very specific, too. It was with regard to the general notion of delayed disclosure, not with regard to this person.
Correct. It was my recollection of the record is that it was just testimony in general about typically when we, see these cases, or kind of how things generally go. So I struggle with the idea. I'm still not sure how I come down exactly on whether they needed to be designated as an expert. I think oftentimes counsel, does. It's just kind of a matter of practice. But I think that ultimately the issue is, was there prejudice? If the state can show that no prejudice occurred at this stage in the proceedings, this court can address that claim. And the state believes that we can show that no prejudice occurred because, based on the information in the record from the testimony given, these two individuals were qualified to discuss the matters that they did discuss. And in the alternate, should this court disagree, the state would submit that the record on direct appeal is not sufficient to discuss maybe reasons counsel had for not wanting to have this person come up and say, this is an expert, here's this expert, and now they're saying things that maybe don't look so good for us. So I think that that would maybe be something that would need to be handled on a post-conviction motion, should this court find that we can't decide the issue of prejudice here.
And beyond whether these two witnesses were experts, is there case law that says this type of testimony is appropriate as long as it doesn't go to an opinion on the particular victim?
Your Honor, I cannot think of a specific case, and that's not an issue that I am deeply researched.
My I don't general, think it was really argued
yeah,
in
yeah, my, my general recollection is that, just from my previous experience, that we've seen this testimony before, but that doesn't mean that it's proper. So I can't really give you an answer
Thank
on
you.
That. So, yep. Unless there are additional questions, we ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. How much time is remaining for appellant?
28 seconds, Your Honor.
28 seconds.
I'll use it all. Thank you. May it please the court. On page 494 of the Bill of Exceptions, the trial judge tells all those who are going to read this, there was no error in this proceeding. But if there was an error, if there were an error, it was harmless. If the court goes back 12 pages, to page 482 of the Bill of Exceptions, you see the tension in this case where the judge states, I did not remove the alternate and I need to. What the court did was propose, and I mean the trial court, propose a B answer to an A question. In other words, the court said, harmless error can be an exception to structural prejudice. And it's Mr. Madron's position that there is no law that supports such an analysis. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Appreciate your arguments today. Your case is submitted and you are excused. And we are now in recess. Thank you.